Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Responding to the terror in Orlando, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The gunman in Orlando proclaimed his allegiance to ISIS, but for at least one terrorism expert, there were other more personal issues involved.
This attack looks to me a lot more like San Bernardino, where you have an individual who has pre-existing issues.
Also, how the Latino LGBT community in Orlando is coping in the aftermath of the shooting.
They may bruise us, but they're never going to break us. And we're going to continue living, and we're going to keep it alive.
Plus, what it's like to be a gay Muslim right now.
Words can't really describe the feeling in the pit of my stomach of being both part of the community of the victim and also the part of the community of the perpetrator.
That's today here on The World. We are all thinking about one story right now, Orlando. But the Orlando story is many different stories. It was a mass shooting, yes, but also an attack on the LGBT community. And since it was Latin night at the Pulse nightclub, also an attack on gay Latinos and so all Latinxes. It was also staged by a man whom former colleagues and his ex-wife have described as unstable and a man who allegedly swore allegiance to ISIS. And it was an attack with a gun. The tragedy in Orlando is all of these things, so we're going to try and pull apart the different narratives from the Orlando massacre. First, we're going to hear from Randy Figueroa. He was a regular at Pulse, and he lost three close friends yesterday in the attack. I asked him how he's dealing with all of this, and if you can ever really move beyond such a loss.
I think the best way that I can move on beyond this would just be to continue living, because I know that's what they want us to do. Our group of friends were so close, and we have each other. And we're holding each other. We're here for each other. We're just going to keep their memories alive and continue to live life for them, because they're not going to want us to dwell on it. They want us to continue living and showing the people who made this happen that we are strong. You know, they may bruise us, but they're never going to break us. And we're going to continue living, and we're going to continue living in their names and their spirits, and we're going to keep it alive.
Randy, as a gay Latinx, what does Pulse mean to you specifically that Saturday night, that Latin night, and what it did for the community?
Growing up in Puerto Rico as a young boy, it wasn't accepted being gay. It's not accepted in a lot of places. Coming to Orlando and being able to come out and have a supportive family and then to be introduced to Pulse, especially the gay Latin community in Pulse, it means the world to me, because I was a people that knew how it felt growing up and the Latin community having to hide it. And over there, we had each other's back. Mm. We were each other's brother, each other's sister, biggest supporter. We were able to have a good time together and accept each other for who we were and not feel shame, outcast about it. And that's the biggest thing to me, that it was our safe haven. It's where we felt free. It was a party. It was a good time. It was a place where we made memories. And for this to happen, it's a tragic loss, and it's just hard.
And when you're not at Pulse in the larger community of Orlando, tell me a bit more about the gay Puerto Rican community in Orlando.
I have my close friends that are part of the gay Latin community. And when we're not at Pulse, we're just always out together, whether we're at the beach or out just having a good time bowling, watching movies. We stuck with each other, you know. We had each other's back whenever things were going on at home. We were there for each other whenever personal issues happened. You know, I counted on my community. And even the straight part of the Latin community were very supportive. And I think it's showing now how strong of a community Orlando has, whether it's straight or gay, because we're all uniting. Everybody's coming together to support one another, because, you know, we didn't just lose our own community. Orlando lost a whole entire community.
So a very different vibe there from growing up in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, very different. In Puerto Rico, it's more keep it on the low. Nobody wants to know. Nobody accepts it, you know, growing up. But over here, it's very be proud, be who you are, and just live your life for you. Don't worry about what anybody has to say or thinking about it.
Randy, will you go back to Pulse? Is that important for you?
Yes, I definitely will. I know for a fact I'm not going to go right away. It's going to take me a minute just because the fact being that it's where my friends lay dead. I don't think I have the courage any right now to walk in there and continue dancing on that dance floor. But eventually, yes, I will go back and I will continue supporting it. I love Pulse. I thank Pulse for many memories and many, you know, the opportunity to meet different people. It's a place that it means the world to me, and I'm never going to stop supporting it.
Randy Figueroa of Orlando, Florida, thank you very much for your time. My condolences again to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Earlier today, I spoke with Mia Bloom. She's an expert in terrorism and mass violence at Georgia State University. And I asked her about President Obama's description of the attack in Orlando as both a hate crime and an act of terrorism.
I think that the president was very on point as far as saying that it doesn't have to be one thing at the exclusion of others. It was definitely a hate crime and it was an act of terrorism. The extent to which it might have either been directed or inspired by ISIS remains part of the mystery that is unfolding. But clearly this is someone who, you know, we might even introduce the fact that his ex-wife, Sitora Yousafzai, says that he was mentally ill. So the issue I would have is, if this was a white person who had done something horrible during gay pride to the gay community, who their ex-wife said was mentally ill and some of their work colleagues said was mentally ill, they would just be mentally ill. And we've had a lot of those examples. The problem is because of the fact that in the middle of the attack, he makes a 911 call and pledges allegiance to ISIS, the whole situation is muddied. And I think that, you know, we have to be sensitive to the fact that he clearly had expressed on several occasions to his father, to his ex-wife, to his colleagues, a hatred both for the gay community and the Jewish community. So this was someone who was homophobic, racist, anti-Semitic. There was a lot going on.
So targeting gays, Latinos, and there's this allegiance to ISIS, it seems. What kind of inquiry lines would you suggest investigators check out?
Well, I think that right now they're going through social media. I saw today an article written by Katie Zavadsky of The Daily Beast that apparently he used to hang out at clubs with drag queens. So I don't know personally if part of the homophobia is extreme interpretation of his own sexual repressiveness. This is not somebody who grew up in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. This is someone who grew up in the United States, watching television, being exposed to things like Will and Grace. This is not someone who's never seen two gay people kiss before, especially if he's hanging out at clubs with people who are cross-dressing. The other thing that I found a little disturbing in terms of the association with ISIS is that it came out that he was trying 2 weeks ago to get onto a VIP list for a different gay club. And so he's basically had 2 weeks to make his pledge of allegiance, and he didn't. What he did do was 20 minutes into the attack, made a 9/11 call, and then made his allegiance. So I just don't find that especially convincing. I think I would need to see more.
So you raised the mental health issue a moment ago, Mia. What would you say is the mental health link between somebody like Mateen? And I know it's still very hard to say because a lot of information is still coming in on all these cases I'm about to mention. But the mental health link between someone like Mateen, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, the man who carried out the Paris attacks, and any ISIS suicide bomber in Syria, are they all on the spectrum of psychological disorders in some way?
You know, it's interesting that psychologists have been looking for the ideal psychological profile of a terrorist for over 40 years. Jerry Post spent his whole career looking for it. And whether it even exists or not remains a question, or maybe it hasn't been found. But over the course of my career of having studied terrorism for 27 years, as well as hundreds of interviews conducted by my colleague John Horgan, what you find with terrorists is that they would not fall under the DSM-4. They would not fall under the category of mentally ill. The vast majority of terrorists are not mentally ill, because a mentally ill person is unstable, they're unreliable, they're not able to maintain operational secrecy. And so terrorist groups tend not to go for mentally ill people.
Mia Bloom, professor at Georgia State University, speaking with us from Atlanta. Thank you, as always.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope this was helpful.
One of the things that was poignant in Orlando yesterday was that rush of people to donate blood to help the shooting victims. But many of the people who wanted to help were not allowed to because of a ban on gay men donating blood. The World's Carolyn Beeler has been digging into the rules governing blood donation for gay men.
Well, Marco, it's being called a ban on gay men donating blood, but actually it's a waiting period. So any man who has had sex with another man within the past year is not allowed to donate blood. So that does rule out a lot of people. And the reason is HIV. HIV infection doesn't show up in blood screening tests right away. So the Food and Drug Administration, who's in charge of this, makes people with a high risk of HIV infection wait for a year to donate blood. That includes men who have sex with men, as well as people who've gotten tattoos or their ears pierced or something like that.
I know there's been a pretty vocal backlash against this rule on Twitter and Facebook since the shooting in Orlando. What exactly are people angry about?
That's right. There has been a lot of pushback on social media. Critics are pointing out that the rules screen out a gay man who, say, has had a monogamous partner for like 20 years, but it would allow blood donation from a heterosexual man who's had multiple partners, may have had unprotected sex. So for the gay population, which obviously has been discriminated against for so long and is now having this horrible event targeted at that population, it's being seen as something that is unfair.
Right, calls of hypocrisy. So the rule that men have to wait a year after having sex with another man, I gather this is actually progress as far as gay rights advocates see it. Explain that.
That's right, Marco. Until December of 2015, so just a handful of months ago, there was actually a lifelong ban on men who have sex with men from donating blood. That was passed by the FDA in the mid-80s when sort of fear of HIV was at its highest. And U.S. authorities actually only changed that after a bunch of other countries moved away from this lifelong ban and toward a one-year wait period, including Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Hungary, Sweden, and the U.K. And the FDA got a lot of its data supporting this policy change from Australia, which had done this, you know, about 15 years ago.
So it sounds like a global trend. Why is it happening now?
Well, like the U.S., a lot of countries instituted this lifelong ban when there was this giant fear of HIV in the 80s. And now as tests are getting faster and better for HIV and infection trends are changing, many countries are moving toward more inclusion. And interestingly, there are some countries that have done away with the wait period altogether and are using more targeted risk assessments for blood donors to look at individual behaviors rather than sort of a whole blanket statement for a whole population. So among those are Italy, which are sort of instituting these more targeted questionnaires.
Mm. What about countries where gay men still can't give any blood at all? They still exist?
There are still a lot of them. And interestingly, some of them are places that we think of as pretty progressive and LGBT friendly. So this is not sort of an issue that can be broken down on LGBT-friendly and not lines.
In the wake of the Orlando shooting, what's the chance that frustration from gay rights advocates will actually change blood donation policies here in the U.S.?
Well, the FDA regulates this, and they did say when they instituted the policy change back in December that they would continue closely monitoring their data and consider any future policy changes. But they do note that they can't really guess how long that might take because science takes a long time.
Right. Carolyn Beeler covers science and the environment for The World. Thanks very much, Carolyn.
Thanks, Marco.
You're tuned to The World. Today we're talking about the attacks in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub in the early hours of Sunday. At least 50 people were killed yesterday, including the shooter, Omar Mateen. His father has said the attack by his son was not about religion, it was about homophobia. But as we've been hearing today on the show, it's difficult to separate the strands. What happened in Orlando has been especially difficult for Sean Ahmed. He lives in Toronto, and he's a gay Muslim. He says he's used to anti-gay violence from extremist groups like ISIS.
This isn't the first time that I've seen ISIS kill gay people. They've been doing it for a long time in Bangladesh. They've been killing gay activists. They've been killing my friends of friends in Bangladesh recently with Zulaz Manan. And also, this isn't the first time I've seen a shooting in the Western world, in America, very close to where I live. But this is the first time where these two worlds have kind of come together, where
there is this shooting. The victims are part of my community because I'm gay. And the perpetrator is also part of my community because he's Muslim. And so words can't really describe the feeling in the pit of my stomach of being both part of the community of the victim and also the part of the community of the perpetrator.
Sean, tell me a bit about your own story as a gay Muslim. You were born in Canada?
Yes, I was. My parents are from Bangladesh, or rather, they were from East Pakistan. They left shortly after a war which turned East Pakistan into Bangladesh. Some of my family didn't survive, and they have many horror stories from the war that they experienced there. My dad fled, and I was born and raised in Canada. I had gone back in 2007 for a few years to do charity work there. Mm. And so that's where I actually came out while in Bangladesh.
So you're 35 now. How old were you when you came out? And what was that experience like coming out first, you know, in Bangladesh, a place where you said a lot of gays have been murdered? And then how did your family react back in Canada?
I came out in 2012, so it's not that long ago. I really struggled about coming out, and it was not under ideal circumstances. I wanted actually to avoid, it's hard to explain. Being Muslim, I knew many the conventional interpretation about homosexuality. I thought it was a sin. I thought it was something that would send me straight to hell. And whereas many gay men come out in their teens or in their 20s, it took me until my 30s for me to accept myself. And part of that process was trying many, many different things. I would try to pray the gay away. I would try to fast, you know, through like Ramadan style fasting, fast it away as if it was some sort of impurity in me.
Were you worried about how your family would react, or were you worried
yes.
about how Islam would react?
I was worried how my family would react because I knew it would cause them pain. And I knew it would cause them dishonor in the culture that they're part of and the family circles that they're part of in the Bangladeshi community and the Muslim community. And I wanted to spare them that pain. But in trying to spare them that pain, I found that I was developing a pain on my own that was almost making me wish I could take my own life. I started the path to accept myself when I turned to online anonymously, this Muslim support group, you know, on Reddit, r/Islam, and I asked them, I'm gay. I've tried everything. I don't think I can change this. What's the lesser sin? Should I take my own life or should I accept that I'm gay? And oddly enough, while there was, of course, a lot of homophobia in the response, the consensus was suicide is the bigger sin. And it should be avoided at all costs. And if accepting yourself as a gay person is what it takes to stay alive, then accept yourself as a gay person. And that was the process for me to start to accept myself. And it was in my late 20s, and I came out when I was 31. And the response from the Muslim community and my family was as expected. My parents wanted to offer an arranged marriage as a cure. My dad even said, we can find a lesbian, and so two people will be cured. You know, you're gay, she'll be a lesbian, and so you both marry, and then two people are saved.
What an intense chapter of your life. So were your parents quoting the Quran when you came out? And what did they say the Quran says about homosexuality?
Well, I came out when I was far away from my parents, which kind of helped. But the first email my father sent me, and I won't forget this, is he offered to help me pray. He offered to help to arrange the marriage, but he sent me a link to the CDC. And maybe
Centers for Disease Control.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's like, you know, I didn't realize this, but if you're gay, you're at a higher risk for all these diseases. So like from a health perspective, you shouldn't be gay because you'll find nothing but disease, depression, and suicide if you go down this path. And so I'm like, gee, thanks. That was not the response I was needing, especially since I had come out under very, very bad circumstances.
How is life for a gay Muslim man in Canada? Or, I mean, Do you attend a mosque as an openly gay man?
There is actually one LGBT friendly community mosque in Toronto. It's called the Unity Mosque, and they recently had a peace iftar. They had people who were gay, bisexual, lesbian, transgendered, two-spirited. Anyone of any kind of any background was welcome to join, and it was really amazing. It's nice to have support in this community. It's a bit complex, though. I can't just say it's perfectly accepting. There are those in the Muslim community who are accepting, but then there are those who are not. In fact, just yesterday, I was being spammed on Facebook by this one Muslim from Mississauga, which is an adjacent town to Toronto or adjacent city to Toronto. And he was replying to every comment my friends were making in response to the Orlando thing, saying, how dare I say I'm gay and Muslim? I'm making a mockery of the religion. He won't tolerate it. And a lot of Muslims are disgusted that I call myself Muslim. So I find hatred in this community sometimes as much as I find acceptance.
And what about your friends? I mean, I assume you have friends who are gay and straight, Muslim and non-Muslim. How are you talking about what happened in Orlando with all these people who know you're a gay Muslim?
The gay community in Toronto has been very, very supportive. They actually, a lot of them have reached out to me saying, I know this must be particularly hard for you because you're both gay and Muslim. And so I'm very lucky. And we have amazing support systems here in Toronto in particular. And there was also a vigil here in the village or in the gay community.
Are gay Muslims in Canada networked with gay Muslims in the United States?
Yes, because coming out as gay and Muslim isn't easy. A lot of Muslims who are gay stay in the closet. And having come out, I don't blame them. There is a lot of family rejection. There's a lot of family pressure. There's a lot of downsides to coming out, especially if your family is conservative Muslim or devoutly Muslim. So often we have this little sparse network that, you know, extends across North America. But there's not like so much as a huge community within Toronto itself, but it's more like an online network, an online support group.
Sean Ahmed in Toronto, thanks very much for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Republican candidate Donald Trump has been quick to use the phrase radical Islam in connection to the Orlando attack, but some see a hidden message there.
This is a way of essentially castigating Muslims without explicitly doing it.
That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're hearing today how Pulse Nightclub was a safe haven for many in Orlando's LGBT community. The club was, as one person put it, where you went to be yourself, to get away from hate, to be free. Many of the victims of yesterday's shootings were young Latinos at Pulse for its Latin night. Rebecca Marquez used to be a regular there when she was a college student in Orlando.
People, you know, when they think of Orlando, they usually think of Disney World, I guess. And it's Orlando is an actual city with actual communities and with a sizable Latino population. So it's kind of a really great way to remind people Latino people are LGBT people at the same time and give that space to really express both aspects of your identity, which kind of gets lost.
Did going to Pulse give you a sense of being more accepted than being in the city at large?
Absolutely. Most queer people would, especially people of color, really do just automatically feel safer in these spaces. And that's what's so beautiful about them. You know, gay bars and gay clubs are more than just a place to drink. This is where we meet. This is where we meet people. This is where you foster a sense of community and kind of grow into yourself and learn from others.
And I gather on a personal level, Pulse was a really important safe zone for you.
Oh, absolutely. That was the first gay club I ever went to. I brought a purse, which if you knew me now, you would just probably laugh right now. I didn't really know how to be me yet. And my friend dragged me there around 18 and I immediately felt welcomed. I immediately felt safe. And I immediately felt like a sense of community there.
Has the thought occurred to you, if this had been another year, another night, it might have been you? I mean, and has that scared you?
That is exactly it. Right now, I'm visiting New York with some friends that I met through Pulse. We went, you know, to a gay club here all together. And the first thought that we all had was, you know, we've been talking about going back to Orlando and doing a trip. And that would have been the gay club we chose for that night. So I think, you know, LGBT people across the United States are feeling that. I don't think it's just unique to us. But of course, it's definitely something that hit really close to home, considering our history with Pulse, and we were all here together. It's something that really does make you feel like, wow, just a year later or another day.
Have you been speaking with friends in Orlando, and what are you hearing from them?
There's a lot of confusion and anger. I just can't imagine what some of my friends are feeling that have lost friends there, you know. But the one thing that is coming out is a lot of love there. And I think that's really important, is that Orlando is more than this. And I hope Pulse can be remembered for more than just the shooting, because it really meant more to a lot of people. A lot of my friends are sharing a lot of pictures from nights that we all spent together. It's a lot of smiling faces. And I think that that's really important to see. You know, just because we have same-sex marriage, that doesn't mean that LGBT people are protected, you know, at the workplace from discrimination. Or, you know, queer people of color and trans women really experience an increased rate of violence. And our safety is not a political talking point. We need to move beyond that and have non-discrimination ordinances that protect LGBT people. We need to protect our vulnerable populations instead of keeping up with this rhetoric that now that there's same-sex marriage, everything's fine. And I think that that's really important.
Rebecca Marquez used to be a regular at Latin Night at Pulse in Orlando. Rebecca, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yesterday's massacre in Orlando left many of us at a loss for words, but not the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump. He didn't hesitate to label the attack radical Islamic terrorism, and Trump challenged President Obama to use the same kind of language. Today, Trump went on to say, "We need to tell the truth about how radical Islam is coming to our shores." The World's Religion reporter Matthew Bell explores how U.S. political leaders are talking about Orlando.
President Obama met with senior security officials today and said investigators are looking at the Orlando mass shooting as a terrorist attack.
It appears that the shooter was inspired by various extremist information that was disseminated over the internet.
Obama said FBI officials are examining those materials to find out more about the killer's motivation. And he said there is a connection between the suspected shooter, Omar Mateen, and ISIS, or ISIL, as the president calls it.
It does appear that at the last minute, he announced allegiance to ISIL. But there is no evidence so far that he was, in fact, directed by ISIL. And there also, at this stage, is no direct evidence that he was part of a larger plot.
The president said, quote, "perversions of Islam on the internet might have been a factor." But as he's done in the past, Obama stayed away from the words radical Islamic terrorism. And that might be wise in this case, according to Mia Bloom at Georgia State University. She's an expert on terrorism and mass violence. And she says it's not clear how much radical Islamic ideology, or ISIS, was the driving factor behind the attack.
This attack looks to me a lot more like San Bernardino, where you have an individual who has pre-existing issues, and then the veneer of the ISIS affiliation provides either a seriousness or a street cred, or even in their perverse way of understanding it, a legitimacy to their actions.
David Gartenstein Ross is a terrorism expert at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He says it's not all that important for U.S. officials to repeat the precise phrase radical Islamic terrorism. What is important after an attack like this, he says, is for Americans to stand together.
You know, the fact is that this is not an attack that represents the American Muslim community. And the American Muslim community has a right to grieve with all of the rest of us and shouldn't be singled out as being different.
But Gartenstein-Ross adds that politicians should not soft-pedal the ideological aspects of what drove this killer to open fire on a nightclub full of people.
He may be many other things as well, but he claimed this attack, you know, on behalf of ISIS, and he went after a set of victims that groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda have been known to target. When you strip aside kind of the politics of the discussion, I think that factually you cannot get around the notion that he is a radical Islamist.
Even so, Shadi Hamid of the Brookings Institution says the political back and forth over the specific phrase radical Islamic terrorism seems pretty irrelevant in the immediate aftermath of an atrocity like this.
This term that Trump obsesses over, radical Islamic terrorism or whatever, is actually a stand-in for something darker, that this is a way of essentially castigating Muslims without explicitly doing it.
Hamid is the author of a new book called Islamic Exceptionalism: How Islam is Shaping the World, where he argues that U.S. policymakers are not very good at talking about religion. And that's especially true when it comes to Islam.
It's the fact that religion plays a more prominent role in many Muslim-majority countries. And I think someone like President Obama, sort of self-styled technocrat who doesn't like to be aroused by the passions of politics, he has, I think, a lot of trouble taking these motivations seriously. The way he's traditionally talked about ISIS, I do think, is problematic, where he dismisses them oftentimes as a bunch of thugs and fanatics, as if he can't even bring himself to take them seriously as a global force.
As for Hillary Clinton, she said today that she will not refrain from using the term radical Islamism to describe the attack in Orlando. That's a shift from her recent rhetoric. But she went on to say that Americans should not demonize or declare war on an entire religion. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Muslims across the country are condemning the Orlando shootings and donating money to help the families of the victims. One fund has already raised $45,000. But Muslims are also facing questions about the image of homosexuality in Islam and why so many LGBT Muslims are still closeted. Imam Abdullah Antepli is a chief representative of Muslim Affairs at Duke University. How did you and Muslims in your community in Durham react to what happened in Orlando, Imam?
Since this heinous, hateful terrorist attack, our life has been upside down. We are trying to respond in prayerfulness, in unity, as we try to uplift the names of those victims who have been targeted to this heinous, treacherous act. We reached out immediately to LGBTQ brothers and sisters in our community. And yesterday, tonight, we will be having peace vigil in various houses of worship and community centers, called that by the leaders of the LGBTQ community and the Muslim leadership here, to make sure this horrible, evil act will not further divide us and polarize us.
So the attacker in the Orlando shootings claimed allegiance to ISIS for his actions in a 911 call, alluding to really the hatred ISIS has for LGBT people. What does Islam say explicitly about homosexuality?
There's a spectrum of views and reactions on the issue of homosexuality. But I think most of what's been said in the past vis-a-vis within the Islamic civilization from a theological, social, or cultural point of view is very much irrelevant today, because what we call civilization or religion is a combination of divine revelation and the human experience. And as human experience have developed over time, over and over, what we understood divine revelation or religion has changed. So in light of what we know, what we have received as a revelation, what we received as a religion, needs to be re-examined, revisited, and re-articulated.
You say in light of what we know, but the religion is up to interpretation, and the we is many, many millions of people. So you would agree that some Muslims around the world interpret those stories differently?
To pick up the worst interpretation, to pick up the most violent and most bizarre, most inhuman interpretation and lift it up as the most authentic, most Islamic, most Christian, most Jewish, is not only inaccurate, it's very unfair to that rich civilization and the 1400 years of Muslim history. Muslims over time have come up with very creative, inclusive, and progressive responses to the issue of homosexuality.
There was a 2014 Pew poll, and according to it, Muslims are split on homosexuality, with 45% saying it should be accepted and 47% saying it should be discouraged. What is your take on this? And especially as the Muslim affairs representative at a university like Duke, where you've got a diverse student body.
What Muslims do or react is not only limited to law. What's being said in the Islamic law and how it's been implemented 300-400 years ago should not necessarily limit ourselves to reach out to a gay Muslim community or the members of the LGBT community from all faiths. Our love, our grace, our welcome, our inclusivity should be including everyone.
Imam, there are many LGBT Muslims around the world. They sit on cultural fault lines. They're blasted for being gay. They're blasted for being Muslim. Do you think what happened in Orlando could possibly be a beginning for Muslim American society to further embrace LGBT Muslims?
I hope so. As we say in Turkish and Arabic, from your lips to God's ears. I hope this heinous act, as Joseph said to his brothers, in itself is evil, but eventually God will create blessings out of it, one of which will be exactly what you said, that American Muslim community or Muslim communities at large will go to a deeper soul search and will try to understand the issue of homosexuality. My heart goes to every members of the LGBTQ community. We are mourning and grieving in solidarity with them. But especially my heart goes to members of the gay Muslim community, because they were already feeling marginalized by their fellow Muslims because of their sexual identity. They were already feeling alienated and marginalized because of their religious identity. This will be another blow to their multiple layers of pain and alienation.
Imam, I'm curious, do you have children?
I have a 15-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old son.
How do you speak to them about an event like this?
We have been having very painful conversations with them. All Ramadan conversations shift into who this person is, whether or not he represents any side of our religion. Where is this deep homophobia and hate to gay community is coming from? Whether this could be ever reconciled any of the teachings of the Holy Quran, which we were about to read before we found out that this is happening. It's been very painful, but I'm hoping eventually rewarding conversations that my children will be in a position to recognize hate in the name of religion or any ideology, and will be fighting against this any form of hate to any community wherever it happens.
Abdullah Antepli is the chief representative of Muslim Affairs at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Imam, thank you very much for your thoughts.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we'll hear a survivor of the Paris attacks reflect on the Orlando shooting. People throughout the world are coming together to commemorate those who lost their lives. You can see just how widespread the vigils are at PRI.org. This is The World. When I heard about the shootings in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, it was hard not to think about Paris 7 months ago today. Again, mostly young people out with friends for a night to have fun and hear music. In Orlando, they were dancing at a club, in Paris at the Bataclan, a concert hall for a show. Hundreds of people trapped inside, dozens of them killed by armed men who claimed allegiance to ISIS. Aurelia Gilbert was one of the people who went to the Bataclan on November 13th. She got out and provided first aid to those in need. Since that night, she set up a group called 13-11-15 Fraternité Vérité. 13-11-15, the date of the Paris attacks, Fraternité Vérité, Brotherhood and Truth. The group helps victims and their families of the attacks get the support they need. Aurelia says they feel a sense of solidarity with people in Orlando.
Of course, we connected as soon as we knew of we had the news of the attack on Sunday. For us, it was Sunday lunch in France when we heard it in the beginning. And of course, we text each other and relatives of who lost their loved one during the attacks in November were so shocked to see that it can happen to other families again. How can it happen again?
And not just the Paris attacks, but specifically the attacks at the Bataclan and similarities of what happened in Orlando, comparisons that have been made quite a bit today, both tragedies unfolding in the dark, loud music playing in very chaotic circumstances. What do you make of those comparisons?
When I heard the first testimonies from the people who were able to escape from that venue in Orlando, I thought it was exactly the same. And their feedback was the same, how they hide themselves, how they run for the life, how they try to text their loved ones. When they had to text and say, I'm so scared, I love you, what will happen to us? It was like if I was 7 months ago and it was happening again. So Of course, there is strong similarity between the two. It's so weird and very shocking for the whole French nation.
One other really striking and important similarity is that in both cases, the attacks were claimed by ISIS. Different kinds of motivation by the attackers, it seems, but the people who carried them out actually grew up in the West, in the same countries where the attacks happened, in the U.S. and France, respectively. What do you think this says about the nature of the security threat we face?
Yes, that's the main point, because it's the first time I saw French or Belgian people coming and kill other French people. So it was really something new for us. It's quite the same in Orlando today. The motivation, I really want to understand. It's been 7 months I've been trying to understand what can motivate someone, and mostly what he calls a religion. And I strongly not believe the religion can be pushing somebody to kill another. So how can somebody can truly believe that he can improve his life and his community by killing other people? That's something that I'm trying to learn after 7 months.
And attacking not just soft targets, but people at leisure, people having fun.
Anybody can be a target now. Previously, during the Charlie attacks, it was because they were cartoonists and satirists. Or maybe it could be a Jewish school. Or here we could say it was a gay club. Anybody can be a target as long as we don't align to what ISIS suggest as a way of life. We will never be afraid, and we will stay strong and believe in what we believe in our society and community. I have two kids, I have two daughters. I don't want to live a world where they would have fear to go anywhere because of guys like that.
So after you emerge from the Bataclan, this happens in Orlando. Have your daughters been asking you about what happened now?
Yes, they were quite also in a shock, and they told me, so this is happening again.
How old are they?
And they are 12, almost 13 and almost 15. Of course, they were really distraught about that, but they've seen that you can go through. When you go through something like that, you have to make something better of it. It's been such terror pain for the people in Orlando today. But what they have to do, they have to unite. They have to feel stronger, and they have to keep something better. They have to turn this tragedy into something beautiful if they can.
Aurélia Gilbert, thank you very much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for welcoming me. And again, we strongly support the community in Orlando today from France.
And in Orlando, city officials are releasing the names of the victims. For Jose Moreno, it feels very personal. He was a regular at Pulse for their Latin nights. He says if it hadn't been for a last-minute change of plans, he and his friends would have been there on Saturday night.
You know, it's just like jaw-dropping how we all, you know, because all of my friends normally go on Saturdays to Pulse because it's like our favorite night to go there. And it's just how shocking that could have been us. And everything that goes through our mind, like how will we react? It just all that fear and all that commotion is just like terrible. We just like, you know, some of us started to cry and like being thankful for, you know, for what we have. So it's just like it's been a lot of mixed emotions going on.
What impresses you most about what you've been seeing on your Facebook page today?
Almost like all of the people I have is saying like, oh my God, my friend passed away, rest in peace. This person is in critical condition. Like all seeing all that, all those stories, all the people like saying that, like crying in all the videos. And it's just been, Facebook has been to another level how depressing it has been.
Jose, what's it like knowing that it could have been you?
It's a little bit terrible. The first thing when I saw the news, and what really shocked me was the mom crying, not knowing what her son, if her son was dead or alive. I just started tearing up because I just thought about my mom, how she would have been devastated knowing that I could have been dead. It just like, that was the first thing that came in my mind, was my mom just crying and devastated. And my whole family and friends is just, it was too much.
Jose Moreno, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Something that emerged from the coverage of the Orlando shootings was a small detail about the music playing in the patio area at Pulse. The DJ had just launched into a set of reggae when the shooting broke out. And that's where I'd like to leave things today. Yesterday, I happened to be driving back to Boston from Connecticut, listening to the coverage out of Orlando, and then I just had to take a rest from it. Turned on the iPod, and the first song out was Bob Marley's High Tide or Low Tide. It helped a lot. So I leave it with you today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow. In high seas or in low seas, I'm gonna be your friend. I'm gonna be your friend. In high tide or in low tide, I'll be by your side. I'll be by your side.
PRI, Public Radio International.